Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
Shawty Red is the secret, man.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 199, a talk with Shorty Red. Shorty is an influential producer best known for his work with Jeezy and Gucci Mane. He has been one of the most important beatmakers ever to come out of Atlanta, and he played a key role in developing the sound of trap music, a sound that is now as close as the nearest radio station or passing car. Shorty started out as part of Atlanta's bass music scene, but his diverse influences and a mistake in the studio, which we'll get to, changed his sound, and he developed a new style that would blossom into trap. You can hear the beginnings of it on his 2000 album with the rapper Drama, Causin' Drama. But it was Shorty's work with Jeezy, starting back when Jeezy was still called Lil J, that pushed him into the spotlight. In addition to his work with Jeezy and Gucci, Shorty Red has made beats for Lil Jon, Pastor Troy, Snoop Dogg, Pusha T, and many more. We spoke with Shorty Red via Skype from Las Vegas. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. By the way, our next episode is a very special episode 200, so you won't want to miss that one. And now, here's the producer who helped bring us the snowman, Shorty Red. Back when you were a kid, I know your mom didn't like you listening to songs with curses. What was your best trick for getting around that and doing that anyway?
I just go to my friend's house and listen over there. His mom didn't care.
Nice. What was kind of the sort of forbidden stuff you were listening to?
Rex and Effects, Naughty by Nature. Who else, man? A lot of people. It's a lot, but I could just remember them off go because Rex and Effects had Rump Shaker. All I want to do is zoom, 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 and a boom. I used to love that song. And Naughty by Nature, man. I'm a huge Naughty by Nature fan.
Yeah. And so, even before you were making music professionally, you were dancing a lot, right?
Yeah, I was. Battling was like a thing we had in Atlanta. You know, we used to call it the Get Out. We used to do the Get Out in Atlanta. So I would battle a lot of people dancing, you know, in teen parties and stuff like that. So, I really got my... A lot of people know me from being a dancer, you know what I'm saying? So when it came to production, it was easy because I have rhythm. I have tempo. it lives in me.
Yeah. And what was your best move back in those days?
Sliding. I could slide like crazy. You know, I slide better than my hand movement. So, you know, everybody, you know, my footwork is crazy. So, you know, they used to call me Baby Michael Jackson.
Wow. I don't know if you get much of a better nickname than that. That's amazing.
Yeah, nice. Man. So,
and even before all that, you moved around a lot because your dad was in the military. Do you remember a lot about moving around in those days?
Yeah, man. My dad, like, he Marine, and we would move to Oceanside, California. I went to school there, Albany, Georgia. I was out there, and Yuma, Arizona, that's where I'm originally from. I was born and raised there. So I kind of like been all over the place. Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee, you know, so I've been around the world. the United States, anyway. Yeah.
And when did you finally get settled in Atlanta metro area? How old were you?
I was 13 when I came to Atlanta. My dad originally from Atlanta. So I came to live with my grandma. You know how parents go through their issues. So it was custody issues. So I ended up, my grandma ended up getting custody of me. And I've been in Atlanta ever since, you know.
And it wasn't long after that even that you started making music. Can you tell me about first starting to play piano? When did you pick up the piano? Do you remember?
I picked up the piano in church. Living with my mom and being in Arizona. My granddaddy was a pastor. So, all my cousins and we all had to play some type of instrument. So one of us would play piano in church. And then we'll switch and one of us would go to the drums. So I kind of was self-taught in the church. And then my mom's boyfriend bought me a Casio keyboard with the little DJ scratcher on there. And I just stayed on that thing, man, and I used to play Prince. I would always try to play Prince records, because I'm a huge Prince fan. So once I mastered playing Purple Rain, I could basically play anything after that.
And some of your first musical experiences professionally were with Twin Productions,
yeah.
Right? You were doing sound and stuff for them. How did that all start?
Like I said, I used to dance at the teen parties in Atlanta. So I would see these guys, they were twins. And I had a friend of mine, that's actually my best friend now. He used to battle with me in the dance off. And he introduced me to the twins. And when I met them, they was like, yeah, man, you could come be a part of our production company, but you gotta work like everybody else work. So, I had to tote speakers and hook the speakers up for Outkast and a lot of groups that was in Atlanta. They realized that I had a good ear for EQing and production. So they kind of just let me do everything when it came to the artists out of Atlanta performing. I wasn't even old enough to get in the club, but I was in the club working Goody Mob mics and Outkast microphone and making sure it doesn't hum or anything like that, making sure they sound good. So, and Raheem the Dream and Kilo Ali and a lot of artists. I was their mic and sound system tech.
So that was the connection to Raheem.
Raheem the Dream is a pioneering Atlanta rapper who was the first local rap artist to be played on commercial radio in the city back in 1986.
I know he hooked you up with some other stuff we'll get into in a minute with some of your first production work.
Right.
So you met him through doing live sound.
Right. I met a lot of people by doing that first. So the relationships was already there.
Nice. And I know I heard one song that was, buried at the very end of a Jermaine Dupri compilation from the City Boys. So who were the City Boys?
The City Boys was part of Twin Production. And when they put me on, they made me part of the group. And we actually was going to do an album because I wasn't on the first album. I had just came into the group and I was going to be help produce the next album. And Lil Mark, if you're familiar with Lil Mark from D4L, he's actually from the City Boys. We all was in that group together. So he wanted to do hardcore rap in Twin Production. They didn't want us to do that because we was kids. So they kind of just dismissed the group, let the group go, man. And I just kept producing.
Are you on that song, City Boy Bounce, the one that's on the compilation?
No, I'm not. I'm not on that song. I just became part of the group right after they did that.
Okay. So knowing Raheem the Dream leads you directly into Drama, right? Which is your first kind of full album production thing. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah. Twin Production had a great relationship with Raheem the Dream. And anybody that we ran into or anybody that they knew, they would always brag about me like, yo, we got this young producer. That's who passed you the mics and he be working your mics. You got to come check him out. And, we had a studio house and Raheem came to the studio house and he listened to my beats and he said, you know what? I'm going to bring you my artist when he gets out of jail and you're going to do his whole album. And by the next week, he brought the artist there, and I did the whole album like within that week. And next thing you know, I'm Shawty Red on the track.
And it's a great album. I know, you know, you say that there's, you know, mistakes in it and you were just learning your machines and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's a great record. And you, when we talked about it before, you told me Drama came into the sessions with lots of ideas for beats. How did you take his ideas and translate them into the finished product that we hear?
Yeah, you know, him being in jail, you know, they always used to beat on the tables and rap while he was in jail. So when he came to my house, he already had songs basically memorized, and he would beat on his chest. And he was like, man, I want the drums to sound like this. And he would beat on his chest. So I had just got on the MPC 2000. I just came off the SP-12, so I was kind of new to it. So I just kind of mimicked everything that he was doing when he was beating off his chest. And I got a few errors in there. And, you know, I'm a perfectionist now, so it's like listening to the album now is like, I have a lot of errors in there because I really didn't know what I was doing, but it won. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a great album. And I think, you know, people who know recognize it as a precursor to a lot of stuff in the South and nationwide that would happen later. And someone who recognized your work on that was Jay-Z, right? Didn't he let you know that he'd heard the Left, Right, Left single?
Yeah, him, you know, drama became a success like really quick. And I ended up meeting Jay-Z, and he was telling me he just did a song, him, Missy, and Drama had recorded a song, and Drama was supposed to go on tour with them. So he was real familiar with my work, and he liked it, you know. So, you know, I at the time, you know, I didn't really look at Jay-Z like I look at him now, you know what I'm saying? I was just like, hey, this is Jay-Z, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, because I was actually invited to his That Your Chick video shoot. And that's when I had a conversation with him. He just told me he met Drama, and they was working on some stuff. And then that was the last time I saw him for a while until I did Jeezy Project. And when I saw him then, he acted like he remembered me. But he didn't really remember me.
Right.
So it was weird. It kind of hurt my feelings because it was like, this guy talked to me for 2 hours, you know, about Drama Project and what I need to do as far as being in the music business and the do's and don'ts and be humble. And then when I saw him after I did the Jeezy Project, you know, it was crazy.
Yeah. But Drama, he never really had a chance to take off because he kind of got locked up again after that album and had to go on hiatus for a bit. What do you think his career or your career, how do you think, you know, your career might have been different if he hadn't gotten locked up?
To be honest, I don't know, man, you know, because he got locked up on the album release date.
Oh, wow.
We just ID'd the suspect as Drama. What's your 20?
On the evening of the album release party for Cause and Drama, Drama, whose real name is Terrence Cook, was arrested for driving without a license and violating his probation. He was only 18 at the time and had already served 3 years for selling drugs. He would also later do 12 years in jail for robbery from 2003 to 2015. Incidentally, when he got out from that bit in jail, he went to visit his lawyer, Real Housewives of Atlanta star Phaedra Parks. After a little confusion, a trip to the wrong floor, and some miscommunication, he wound up arrested for a bomb threat. Drama went to the wrong office when trying to bring Parks his new mixtape. Apparently, according to his mother, Drama told the receptionist there, "I have a bomb CD. It's about to blow up. I have a bomb-ass CD in the car." He was charged with making terroristic threats and creating a false public alarm. All charges were eventually dismissed. Causing Drama, indeed.
Major. So, I don't, you know what I'm saying? Me personally, I think Drama was out of here. Like he would probably be your top five right now. You know, if he would have stayed out of trouble, he would probably be, because you know, our biggest fans were military. That's what his biggest fan base.
Well, it makes sense. All of his songs have that kind of martial, you know, military thing going on.
Yeah.
Lay, 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 lay.
Military in Chicago. Chicago loved him. And the Marine, the military, all the military. So I think he would have been very successful if he would have stayed out of trouble.
You told me one of your early mentors, production-wise, is a guy named Half Pint, who I wasn't able to find that much about. So who is he and what'd you learn from him?
Half Pint, I can't even remember his song, but Half Pint used to produce for Luke, Uncle Luke. So he did a lot of production for Uncle Luke and Trick Daddy. And he actually came out, he was a bass artist out of Florida.
Half Pint, want you to hold that leg up. Pick it up, pick it up.
And he was very successful. And he's the one who mentored me and showed me how to use the SP-1200. And a lot of my 808s and my hard-hitting sounds came from him. And his sounds, like, you don't really hear those sounds nowhere. I'm, like, probably, like, the only one that got those type of 808 drums and snare. Well, you know, people got it now because, you know, I done did a lot of track outs, but... You know what I'm saying? But Half Pint, he's the one who showed me. He came in and when nobody was really trying to help me, and I was getting frustrated because I was reading the books and the books wasn't really teaching me. I couldn't understand the books. So he said, you know, put the books down and just do what you feel. Once you learn this, once you learn how easy it is to do this and do that, you're out of here. And he showed me that, and the next thing you know, I was the youngest producer in Atlanta. Out
right.
of Atlanta. So.
Right. For context here, you were about what, 17 when you were doing the drama stuff, right?
No, actually I was 15 turning 16.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then by the time it came out, maybe you were
came out majorly, I was probably like I probably just turned 17.
Amazing. I heard some of the stuff you did with 404 Soldiers, which is I would almost think kind of crunk, right?
Yeah. Four Soldiers, I was watching them on TV one day. We had a TV show, a basic cable show. I can't even remember guy's name. He passed away, but everybody would watch his show to see the video. And I saw this group on there, and I just said to myself, I was like, man, I want to work with these guys. And the next thing you know, they was at my door, and I don't know how they was at my doorstep. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They was at my doorstep, and... I ended up producing them, and they got signed to Epic. They did a song called Walk Like a Soldier with Rashida. And Rashida had just left the Capers, the group called the Capers, and she was working on her solo project at the time. I think she had that song, Do It, with Pastor Troy and Quavo Gold. Come on, let's start this shit. Shawnee, let's crank this shit. A little something for them hating hoes. Hook is numb with the knees and bowls. Why y'all all in my grill? Why y'all can't keep it real? Always trying to plot and scheme. Wanna live this life, it's just a dream. And she was friends with the manager of 404 Soldiers. The manager of 404 Soldiers is Kirk's best friend.
Shawty is referring to Rashida's husband, manager, and now Love and Hip Hop Atlanta castmate, Kirk Frost.
That's how she ended up getting on the song. And when she got on the song, it took off. It blew up. And next thing you know, they were signed to Epic Records. And I don't know what happened after that.
404 Soldiers released their album on Epic Records, also called Walk Like a Soldier, in 2001. However, you can't find that album anywhere. They released another album, All Out War, in 2004 on Big Cat Records.
Yeah, so the stuff you did for them was really just energetic and aggressive, not fast exactly, but really energy-filled. Did you get that from their delivery? Was that a sound you had in mind already?
No, that was just me. You know, I just did what I feel. It was like I wanted to be better than the Drama Project, you know, and it was crazy because, you know, Drama was doing Soldier stuff, Soldier music. And I ended up getting these guys, so I didn't want these guys to sound like Drama, you know. And plus, they didn't rap like Drama, so I kind of catered I catered my production to how they rap. You know what I'm saying? So I just play, man. That's what I do. I just play, and if I can make the drums bring out the vocals the best way I can, you know what I'm saying? And that's what I do, man. I don't really have a set pattern.
So you worked with Jeezy obviously very early on. You know, I know you met him and you were friends kind of before you started working together, but you did stuff, you know, even the stuff he recorded under the name Lil J.
Yeah.
Some of those songs. His voice even sounds different when he was under that different name. What changed in terms of you recording his vocals between the Lil J stuff and the stuff he did under Young Jeezy?
To be honest, Jeezy had been with me around the time Drummer got out and when 404 Soldiers album came out. So he had always been there with me around that time. So he always was in the studio with me or just hanging out, you know what I'm saying? So when he wanted to just rap, he sounded like, when I listened to his old stuff, he sounded like Trick Daddy. He was a huge Trick Daddy fan. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I was like, man, you even sound like Trick Daddy. You know what I'm saying? How's this gonna work? Like, we can't do this. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, we did a couple of records, but, you know, a lot of people, it was like, he sound like Trick Daddy, you know? And the funny thing about it, he actually was gonna change his name to Hollywood, and I think that was, I think one of Trick Daddy's friends or brother or something like that did pass away.
Trick Daddy's older half-brother, Derek Harris, was known as Hollywood. He was shot to death inside of a parked car in 1994.
Because they came at us both about changing our name because Michael Bivins had that group called the Pee Wee All-Stars, and this dude had a name called Shawty Red. And then Jermaine Dupri put out an artist named Lil J.
That's me, Jay, I'm the one. Your sign's looking quiet, won't you slide here, hun? Let your hair down, let's have some fun. It's a weekend and the party just begun. So
he had to change his name, that's why he changed his name to Jeezy.
Oh.
But I was able to keep my name because I had my name first.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So, you know, when he changed his name, he was going to change it to Hollywood. And I was like, man, no, you already sound like Trick Daddy. You can't change your name to Hollywood. You know what I'm saying? So I was like, we got to figure this out. And how his flow pattern changed, I kind of just told him to stop writing because he would write. And I had just got the Mackie set up. It was like the first setup in Atlanta. I bought it from Guitar Center. And I didn't even know how to work that. So I would have him do like bars, like just freestyle this, and then we're gonna go to the next line, you know, because I didn't know how to punch in or nothing like that. So I would just have him do like two bars, stop, do two more bars, but just off the top of the head, don't write anything. And if you notice on his first album, that's where the ad-libs come in, because I was recording, so the ad-libs always came in to fix that gap, to cover up the gap that I had, because I didn't know how to punch in. It's like my brain on drugs.
See me out, nigga, I do my thing in clubs. A punch-in is when you go back and record over a spot in a track where there might have been an error. If you don't know how to make punch-ins, the only thing for you to do is record a whole other track to cover up a mistake or a gap in the track. By having Jeezy record ad-libs, Shawty could fill any of those blank spaces.
And that's where the flow came from.
That's amazing. And so you would just sit there and say, okay, well, we're going to make a song two lines at a time just until we're done.
Right. That's how we would do. You know what I'm saying? And when we kept doing that, it was like two bars ended up becoming four bars and then so on and so on. So he mastered that. And it was so easy after that. You know what I'm saying? It just kept getting better and better, you know, because I would make the beat on the spot. I would sit there and play while he's coming up with his bars in his head. So we never really had any beats just sitting there. Everything was, while he was coming up with the lyrics, I was actually sitting there playing.
And so many of your Jeezy songs, especially on that first record, stuff like Get Your Mind Right and Air Forces, of course, have really memorable intros.
I'm the realest nigga in it. You already know. Got Trap of the Year 4 times in a row.
What they give?
A lifetime supply of baking soda clientele. A Rolex watch, 2 pot, and 3 scales. It's the drop top Porsche. Couldn't walk a mile off in my Air Force.
What to you is the secret of a good intro?
Ah, man. Shawty Red is the secret, man. But nah, it's I wanted to do something different because everybody, the song always came on, you know, songs back in the day, they just came on the same, you know, and I wanted to build it up because, like, I'm a huge fan of, like, comic book movies and Batman and, you know, movies like that. So I like them themes. So I was like, man, what you talking about? It needs to have like a theme at the beginning. Like, it got to come on like this. It got to come on crazy. And he just rolled with me on that. You know what I'm saying? I was like, let's make movies. Let's make street movies. And he rolled with me on that. That just became the formula.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. A lot of your tracks have this kind of like movie soundtrack and even almost like horror movie soundtrack vibe to them sometimes.
Yeah, I love horror movies too as well. Like, I watch horror movies every day. Like, still to this, I watch horror movies and Batman movies. You know, I just, every day I'm watching movies like that, every day.
So one of the things that you do in production is to differentiate the hook, you'll sometimes strip down or even drop the drums out entirely.
Yeah.
To kind of make the hook stand out.
The light switch, I'm trying to keep the sound on.
Can you talk a little bit about that, about some of your ideas around arranging?
When I arrange, man, I just go off what I feel. You know what I'm saying? Like, to be honest, like, I'll probably do like an 8-bar sequence and just let Jeezy do what he needs to do. Well, back then I used to do that. Mm-hmm. And once he recorded the full song, I would just break it down after. And mm-hmm. whatever I felt at that moment, you know what I'm saying, that's how I would break the beat down. So, because I knew it had to have a change, like, couldn't sound the same all the way through because you'll get bored. And by me being a dancer, you know, you can't have music to bore you. You know what I'm saying? You got to have some music that keeps you moving, keep you bouncing. You know what I'm saying? So that was my little trick, like, speed up the hi-hat because nobody's doing it like this, or make these 808s sound like this, or, you know, take this snare out, and take this clap out, you know? So that was just my formula, you know?
Yeah. One thing that shows up a bunch in your songs and that has come to be associated with trap music is hitched snare roll, right? The snare that kind of starts high and goes low, or the reverse.
Yeah.
Usually towards the beginning of a song. When was the first time you remember hearing that?
I mean, that's a tough question because, you know, I want to credit myself for it, but I can't really credit myself for it because my sound is actually a slowed up bass sound. Mm-hmm. That's what people don't get. You know, bass music was real hot in Atlanta. So I made a mistake one day and turned the tempo down on my beat machine, and that 808, because that 808 kick that I use, that sub 808 that I use, it's for booty shape, because I didn't know how to play bass lines. Well, I knew how to play bass lines, but I never had a hard hitting bass that I liked. You know what I mean? So when I made that mistake and the beat slowed down, it kind of sounds like what you're hearing now from me and Jeezy.
That makes sense.
So those snare rolls that I put in there with the different pitch, that's what we used to do in bass music.
Yeah. Do you remember what track that was? Was it something you ended up using, the one that slowed down accidentally?
It was a track I was actually doing for Drama, but we never used it. But I remembered that. I was like, you know what? That's going to be my new sound. You know what I'm saying? Because I like how that bass is hitting from that 808, you know, real slow. Like, I was like, man, I don't never have to use a bass line or nothing. I just use that 808. So I just kind of instilled that into Jeezy. Because like I said before, I wanted 4-4 Soldier stuff to be different from Drama. And I wanted Jeezy stuff to be different from 4-4 Soldier. Yeah. So when I made that mistake, that kind of was the bounce for Jeezy.
Yeah. So, you know, I talked to DJ Tomb not that long ago, someone who was doing kind of similar stuff right around the time you were. He told me that one of his big influences in the sound that of what would come to be called trap was stuff Curtis Mantronic was doing back in the 80s. Come on, this ain't no app, this ain't no game, this is trap.
DJ Toomp is another key producer in the development of trap music. His work with T.I. helped not only to define the style's sound, but also through his work on T.I.'s 2003 album Trap Music to even give it a name. Toomp, like Shawty, has roots in Atlanta bass. His earliest songs were with Raheem the Dream. Sean talked to Toomp for an upcoming article in Complex. Toomp said that the 1986 Tila Rock song Bass Machine, produced by Curtis Mantronic, was a big influence on him and many other Southern producers as well.
Kicking it live on the Bass Machine, better known as the Roland 808. Beats, we call them Mantronic, and I am T-Lock.
Was that something you were aware of?
I mean, to be honest, nah, man. Like I said, like I listened to Prince, so I listened to Prince, and I was listening to whatever was going on in Atlanta, you know. So that's kind of like before my time. That's probably like the first time I ever heard that guy's name.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be honest with you,
sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
So, sure. So I wouldn't know, you know.
Yeah. One of your influences you did mention, who I wasn't familiar with at all, was the Dayton family.
Yeah.
What about them made an impact on you?
The music. If you listen to the Dayton family's production, you know, it was so dope. And then, you know, they was talking about the streets.
So what the fuck you want to do? Niggas and bitches are catching bullets and cops are catching sluts too. Two strings on a fucking loose, creeping in the fucking deuce.
You know what I'm saying? They talked about the real, you know, that we all could relate to. You know what I'm saying? Like UGK or, you know, Ghetto Mafia. A lot of those people, man. You know what I'm saying? So they was before us. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
You know, they had an influence on me because I just love the sound of the music. You know what I mean?
Did you work with Ghetto Mafia at all?
No, I never worked with Ghetto Mafia. I never end up. Ghetto Mafia is like, you never see those guys unless they perform. And when they perform, you couldn't even get close to those guys.
They got us trapped in this hellhole. Niggas selling dope to cope with the problems of the hood.
Ghetto Mafia were an Atlanta rap duo who released 4 albums on 3 different labels in the 1990s before taking a 7-year hiatus until their comeback album in 2005. A decade after that, they returned with a new single, Elephant in the Room.
I know them to this day, you know what I'm saying? I know them now, but I never had the privilege to produce them.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've talked a lot, obviously, about the 808, the Roland TR-808 drum machine and how you've used its sounds and put its sounds in other drum machines. The head of Roland, the guy who actually designed the 808, just passed away as we're talking.
Right.
Roland Corporation founder Ikutaro Takahashi, who invented the TR-808 and countless other drum machines and synthesizers, died on April 1st, 2017.
What did that machine and what did its sounds, what did they mean to you?
I mean, it means a lot because, you know, if it wasn't for that guy, my family wouldn't be eating. I wouldn't be successful. You know what I'm saying? I'd probably still be in the streets if it wasn't for that guy building, you know, bringing that to the table for us. You know what I'm saying? So I have much respect for that guy. You know what I'm saying? Rest in peace. But yeah, man, like a lot of us wouldn't be who we are if it wasn't for that guy.
Yeah. And what about that machine's sounds made them work for you so well?
I mean, just hard hitting, like, you know, that hard hitting analog sound.
Milky! psycho killer. Qu'est-ce que c'est? Pop, 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 pop.
Surprisingly, considering its now iconic status, the Roland TR-808 was a failure when it was launched in 1980. Its high price, over $3,400 in today's dollars, didn't help. The company stopped making the machines after only 3 years.
Man, like, you can't beat that, you know? And, like, even, like, with the Phantom, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, those sounds, man, it's just those raw, edgy sounds, man. Like, you know, you can't beat it. I can't explain it, man, you know, because I can't really break down the technical part of it,
but right,
if it wasn't, those sounds made me feel something. Those sounds make me be a very creative person,
yeah.
You know what I'm saying, as far as production. So, you know,
yeah, they're so distinctive too. I mean, they don't sound anything like an actual drum kit, which is one of the reasons that the machine wasn't successful at first.
Right.
So, you know, as far as your music, you once said the strip club has always been my radio station.
Right.
What have you learned over the years about what kinds of beats, what kinds of songs work in strip clubs?
To be honest, man, I didn't really learn anything out of that, you know, because, you know, Jeezy stuff, the stuff me and Jeezy did, it was riding music. Like, it was for the car, you know, for people that had speakers in their trunks and stuff like that. So to hear it playing in the club, that kind of threw me off. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, when you hear Hypnotize playing in the strip club, you're like, hold up, what's going on? You know what I'm saying? Like, so after that, it was just like, whatever I did, it was able to be played in the strip club. And that's why I say the strip club is my radio station, because, you know, you couldn't really get your songs on the radio.
Mm.
So you can go to the strip club, and as long as you were somebody and the DJs knew who you was, they was going to play it.
Mm.
You know, so salute to all the DJs, you know what I'm saying, on my behalf, to show me love, you know what I'm saying? They play anything. If I had it, they played it.
Yeah.
Like, it could have been a new artist. Like, oh, you produce what? Oh, yeah, let me play it. You know what I'm saying? So, you know.
Yeah. What's the song of yours that has worked best over the years in strip clubs?
I would say my Drifter record I did that. Got Lee.
I'm a drifter.
And I'm going to say that record for the simple fact that somebody leaked that record. I was drunk one night and I was in the room. I was at home chilling with my homegirl, Roxy Reynolds. I don't know if you're familiar with her, but she's a porn star. And she likes when I go in the studio and do my little harmony thing. So we was drunk one night. I went there and did that song, Drifter. And one of my associates ended up leaking that song. And Snoop ended up wanting to buy that song, because he heard it. The song reached California. I didn't even know the song was playing in California. And I had already been dealing with Daz and Corrupt, you know what I'm saying? So they was already trying to get Snoop, you know, get me a placement on Snoop album anyway. So when he heard Drifter, he tried to buy Drifter. And at the time, Sylvia Rome was signing me to Universal Motown as an artist. And I couldn't sell Snoop that song, so I ended up making Sexual Seduction.
Oh, I'm not gonna rush the stroll, so she can get a sexual eruption. So I can get a sexual eruption.
Shawty is actually conflating the titles of two versions of the same song. The clean version of Snoop's hit is Sensual Seduction, and the dirty version is called Sexual Eruption. Sexual Eruption was nominated for a Grammy in 2009 for Best Rap Song, but it lost to Lil Wayne's Lollipop.
And that is all because of the strip club. So I would say that song ended up getting me nominated for a Grammy for Sexual Seduction. So I would say that song.
Yeah, and you got Snoop to appear on the remix, too.
Yo, Shorty Red, It's your uncle Big Snoop Dogg. We done already gave him a sexual eruption. Let's see if we can get our drift on. Let's drift from club to club. Yeah, strip club, that is.
Yeah, I did, you know, and they dropped the ball on that, which, you know, I hated that song. But they dropped the ball on that, you know what I'm saying? They ended up giving that version to DJ Clue. So the whole South was mad at me. And I was like, I had nothing to do with that. That was Universal Motown fault. Mm-hmm. So they kind of stopped playing the record because they was like, how you going to give a New York DJ? I was like, I didn't do that. You know what I'm saying? Because you know how DJs are, you know, at that time, you know, South DJs used to always try to compete with New York DJs. So they was upset with me. So that record kind of just never got played. Yeah. I didn't really like that record anyway. Yeah.
And I know you were working for a while, or you were talking about maybe around 10 years ago, you were talking about, oh, I'm going to do a solo album and it's going to be kind of a concept thing and it's going to be called Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah.
You released a mixtape with that name, but it's very different. It's, you know, mostly a collaboration with Stewie Rock. You didn't really do a lot of the music on it.
Stewie Rock. Oh, oh, Shotty Red.
Tell me the story of Jekyll and Hyde.
Jekyll and Hyde was actually supposed to come out. I was signed to an artist right after I did Drama album. I got signed to MCA Records. And I actually had six of my original songs in the Save the Last Dance movie. And I had one of the songs on the soundtrack.
Shawty's Let's Get Crunk appeared on the 2001 album More from Save the Last Dance, music from the motion picture. Multiple other songs, including Everything Is Business, Big Ballin', and Shake Something, appear in the film itself.
So the Jekyll and Hyde concept came from my A&R. He was like, we got to switch up. We got to do something because they just dropped Nelly. So at the time, it was like, you can't do the singing and rapping because they're putting all their money into Nelly. And you have to be different, so you have to switch it up. So I was like, man, I'm a producer. I want to show the world that I can do. I have several different styles of music. You know what I'm saying? So that's where the Jekyll and Hyde came from. And the version that Stewie Rock put out, I was actually working with him at the beginning of his. I was kind of his mentor with that sound. So when he said he wanted to do a Jekyll and Hyde project, at the time I was in jail. So I just let him go on and just do what he wanted to do with it. So he arranged that. So a lot of the songs, you know, he picked the arrangement. You know what I'm saying? A lot of my songs, I just kind of like, I'm sitting on them now. I have a lot of them songs, but I'm just sitting on them because they're great songs and I don't feel like they should be out for free.
You know? Right.
Because I have songs with like John Legend, a lot of people, you know what I'm saying, that you wouldn't even expect me to have on my album. So I just don't feel like it should come out free as a mixtape.
Right. Yeah, I hope they get to see the light of day.
I'll release them one day, eventually. Yeah. You know, the music game changes every day. So it's like, you know, you want to do it right.
Yeah. You mentioned, you know, being in jail, and I'm assuming that had something to do with what happened in 2010, right? At the New Year's.
Yeah.
So you went through pretty much all of 2010, from literally New Year's Day until about November, with a murder charge hanging over your head. What was your state of mind like during that period?
It's hard to explain, and to be honest, I don't really want to get into too many details about that. But
of course,
I was just like, you know, I just got nominated for the Grammy, and I'm trying to how can I say it? Trying to finally switch up the persona of Shawty Red and be the mogul. And then that happens. So it's like, not only am I thinking about my career, I'm thinking about my life on the line. You know, it was a lot of stuff going on, you know. So You know, that county was the last county to free the slaves.
Henry County, Georgia, where Shorty's trial was held, has an extensive history of racial tension, which, as he suggests, goes back a very long time and runs very deep. It was just in the news in the fall of 2016 when a member of the Board of Elections was caught sharing racist posts on social media. The county has had a huge influx of black residents in recent decades, moving from being almost 90% white in 1990 to 60% white in 2008, which has served only to heighten the longstanding tensions.
So it's a lot. It's a lot, you know, and I'm going to detail. I got a book. I wrote a book. So, you know, I'm going to eventually put that out. You know what I'm saying? And it go into more details, but
sure. And you know. And what you hinted at, the racism in that county, was that one of the reasons you decided not to have a jury trial, or was that your decision?
To be honest, it's how can I explain it? I was in Henry County, so Henry County, I've been in Henry County for a long time, not knowing the racism out there. So either way, it was a bad idea to do a jury trial, you know, because I wasn't going to get a fair trial.
Right.
A trial by judge, or bench trial as it is more formally known, is obviously an exception to the standard process of a trial by jury as required by the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution. By federal law, the only way a bench trial may occur instead is if first the defendant requests a waiver in writing, then the government prosecutor's consent, and then the court approves the request. While in some states this has led to some battles between defense attorneys and prosecutors, other states, such as Maryland, have opted for more streamlined systems. Interestingly, in the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore, two of the police officers chose to have a bench trial rather than face a jury. In Shawty's situation, it certainly seems the correct decision was made, especially when you consider the history of the county where the jury would have been drawn from. He was cleared of all charges on November 3rd, 2010.
You know,
yeah.
You know, they didn't want me out there anyway.
Right.
Point blank, period.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I wasn't going to get a fair trial, you know, so, you know, I roll with my, you know, I had super lawyers. So, you know, it's like, man, let's just roll with the judge, man.
Yeah. And Jeezy lived with you for most of that period, right?
Yeah. He was with me the whole time until I had to start prepping, you know, prepping for court.
Like literally lived in your house, in your guest room for that period.
Yeah. He stayed with me. You know, like me and Jeezy relationship, you know, we're like brothers, you know. So he's been through situations like that. So for him to miss tours and you know, miss out on money, you know what I'm saying, to be there with me, you know, I think that was the dopest shit you could ever do. So that's a real friend. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely.
So yeah.
I wanted to ask about the song you did with Pusha T, the Amen track with Pusha and Kanye and Jeezy.
And you might get the mound, yeah, cause I'm calling an elf on a sleigh. Me and Pusha back on it. Now everybody help us pray. Lord, forgive my sins and all my friends. Dollars make sense. I'm trying to get paid. Trying to get
paid. So, you know, when we've talked before to people who have worked with the super superstars, the Kanyes and Drakes and Jay-Z's,
right?
You know, the stories we hear from producers are there's a lot of delays, and then there's a lot of, okay, you have to make big changes in the last minute in literally no time. That seems to be kind of the how stuff goes. You're waiting and waiting and waiting, and then, hey, make this big change in 12 hours. Is that
right?
Is that how things work with Amen?
Nah, man, you know, to be honest, that was, Amen was supposed to be TM-103. That whole Last Laugh mixtape was TM-103, the original album. But something was going on with Def Jam.
You gotta get it in, bro. Let's get our heads, let us pray. Thanks to the day.
Shawty is referring to Jeezy's 2010 mixtape, The Last Laugh, which contained an earlier version of Amen without Kanye or Pusha. Jeezy's TM-103 album would eventually be released in December 2011.
And Def Jam and Jeezy. So it ended up becoming a mixtape. And Amen, I didn't have nothing to really do with Amen. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Pusha T manager called me asking me for the checkout file. And I was like, hey, you got to talk to Jeezy about it. You know what I'm saying? And because he was like, you know, Kanye and Pusha T want to use it. So he called me and I was like, I'm not sending you no files. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, the next thing you know, the song was out.
Oh,
you know?
Okay.
And I never got a check for that song.
Oh.
You know what I mean? It was never no paperwork on that song. You know what I mean? So I'm kind of upset, but, you know, I'm upset because, you know, I never got to. I worked with Pusha T on Cliff's album. I actually got in the studio with them. So they some good dudes. So I didn't. That's why I never really get mad about the situation. Mm-hmm. But I've met Kanye once, but I've never been in the studio to be able to work with him because there's too many middlemen and shit.
Wow.
You know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I'm kind of pissed off about the A-Man record because I didn't get a check for it. It came out and it's like, well, damn, y'all don't even want to come fuck with me on your album. Y'all fuck me on the record, but y'all can't put me on the new albums. You know, so that's how I kind of feel about that record.
When were you working with the Clips?
I think it was around their second album. They was working on their second album and something happened with it. And it got delayed.
These are the days of our lives, and I'm sorry to the fans, but them crackers won't play a fair job. I know.
Clips' second album, Hell Hath No Fury, was delayed for several years while the group was caught up in label mergers and contract issues. They started work on the album in late 2003, but it wasn't released until November 2006. We discussed the delay with No Malice in episode 78.
So when it got delayed, I guess they ended up redoing a whole nother album. You know what I'm saying? So. But I actually was in the studio, like, you can actually Google it, because they put it out there that they was in the studio with me. It's somewhere online, somewhere. But yeah, I was actually in the studio working with them, and they some cool dudes. I fuck with Clips, man. You know what I'm saying? They some dope-ass dudes.
Yeah. One of the kind of lesser-known artists you've worked with who I liked your stuff with a lot was Kingpin Skinny Pimp. Who also has a great rap name. What was it like working with him?
I mean, it was dope because, you know, I'm a huge fan of Skinny Pimp and 3C Mafia. Because when I was in Memphis with my dad, you know what I'm saying? Because he was stationed out there. Those guys were underground, stupid hot. I've never seen rap artists that hot underground. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Until me and Jeezy came out. You know what I'm saying? But those guys was hot and the rest of the world didn't know them. So, like, for that guy to come to my house and is my friend to this day, you know what I'm saying? That shit was a blessing, like, to you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm a huge fan because he can rap his ass off.
Yeah, definitely. You worked a lot with Gucci, obviously. Gucci. Let's go. When you're doing stuff with him, do you make beats specifically for him? What is a Gucci main beat to you?
Yeah, everything custom. I'm from the old school, so, you know, you had to make beats on the spot. You know what I'm saying? There wasn't no USBs, and, you know, I come from ADATs and D88s. You know what I'm saying? So, you know what I mean? Cassettes, we didn't even have a DVD, a CD recorder. You know what I'm saying? So, you had to make spot. You had to make beats on the spot. You know, so, and still to this day, I'm like that. People ask me for beats, I'm like, dog, I make custom beats. You know? So a lot of people, I don't work with a lot of people because they want me to send them shit. And I'm like, you're not finna mixtape me.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So when I'm in with Gucci, like, Gucci doesn't like, even if I have beats just sitting there now, Gucci, no, Charlie, you got to make it on the spot. You got to make it on the spot. You know what I'm saying? So when I do Gucci beats, I kind of give him my signature drums, you know what I'm saying? But I make his music more animated. Because of his voice. He has an animated voice. You know what I'm saying? So Jeezy stuff I do darker and Gucci stuff I make animated. Sometimes I give him some dark stuff. It depends on his mood. You know what I'm saying? If he asks for it, then I give it to him. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And you work fast, man. I saw a video of you sitting down with a machine and coming up with a beat in 9 or 10 minutes, maybe 15 if you count the intro and outro you made. Do you always work that fast?
Man, I make beats fast. You know, that's where my success came from, because people actually didn't think I could make beats that fast. So people were more, they was paying me more for me to come in the studio and see the show. All the artists that I produced a lot of artists. Most of them would love to film it. This dude don't make no beats that fast. So I make beats really fast. You know what I'm saying? To the point where I got to slow down now, because, you know, you had us, the middleman people be like, oh man, he whipped that beat up so quick, man. You know, maybe you need to try to get him to make another one, you know.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, nah, you know, because I was always taught the faster you make the beats and you do a professional job, the quicker you get paid, you know.
Yeah.
So Twin Production always taught me that, you know, they taught me, like, the faster you get it done, the richer you get, the more success you have. You know what I'm saying? And people going to request you before they request this person. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I make beats fast. And that video I put out, man, like, I was just playing around. I had just got that. Akai had just sent me the Renaissance. And I just had it sitting in the box. And I had one of my young producers come over. And he was like, man, please, just, man, do something. So I wasn't even trying to make a beat. I was just, I was trying to go bowling. So that was just something. I didn't even know people was filming me until I looked.
Well, it's a great video. We'll definitely link to it in the show notes. So you've worked with both Gucci and Jeezy. Without getting into particulars and without asking you your feelings about those particulars, there was a period where they didn't like each other at all.
Where you China, you wings at? Where you bling at?
Back in 2005, Gucci and Jeezy had a disagreement over who was going to use their first collaboration, Icy. After several verbal jabs back and forth, including Jeezy putting a bounty on Gucci's chain, four men broke into a house where Gucci was visiting and started assaulting him. Gucci shot one of the men, who was later found dead. That man, Henry Lee Clark III, a.k.a. Pookie Loke, was a rapper signed to Jeezy's label. Jeezy denied any connection to the home invasion, and Gucci, who maintained that he acted in self-defense, was acquitted of Clark's murder the following January.
Was that awkward for you?
Oh, yeah, I was in the middle. I was in the middle, because what a lot of people don't know, I'm the one actually put them on the phone together. Because I was working on Jeezy's Streets Is Watching when I was working on Gucci's first album at my house. So I would have Jeezy come through, and then Gucci would come through later on that day. But they never met each other. So I put them on the phone, and then the next thing you know, they went and did some records with Zaytoven, and then all hell broke loose. You know what I'm saying?
So, right.
You know, that put me in a situation, because I'm like, you know, Jeezy my brother and Gucci my friend. So, you know, that whole beef was crazy to me. And I was in the middle of it, because, you know, you got Gucci sideline entourage mad at me. And then you got the entourage of Jeezy that don't even really, I don't know most of these niggas. You know what I'm saying? So everywhere I would go, I would be in some shit because of these two guys. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, and I'm just me. So I would always have a problem, man. You know what I'm saying? Always have a problem. So it was awkward.
For sure. One of the many positive things Jeezy says about you is that you're a great cook. So what's your favorite dish to make?
Everything I cook my favorite, but I can tell you what Jeezy like. Jeezy like my grilled chicken breast. Yeah, my grilled chicken breast and eggs, man. He like, man, we don't need no Waffle House. So you know what I'm saying? He like, Shawty, come over, man. What you cooking? You know, so. Yeah, he likes that, man. But I could kind of just make everything, man. You know what I'm saying? Eventually, I'm going to have a restaurant. That's my plan, to have my own restaurant.
Yeah. What do you have? You have a name picked out?
Not yet. I'm playing with a few names, but, you know, I don't want to say too much. But but my restaurant is going to be like, it's going to be dope. It'll be for artists, though. It wouldn't be for the public.
Yeah. All right. Well, I hope you'll let me in when I come down to Atlanta.
Of course, man.
All right. So what's going on now? I know you had the three-song EP that Gucci just released of, you know, all your stuff.
Hey. Let me take you back to my shouting red days. Just soaking bells pulled up to the club blaze. In an all red Georgia.
What else is going on?
Well, you know, we put Trapper.3 out.
Mm-hmm. I said I hopped up by that G.
Jody produced three songs on Jeezy's 2016 album, Trap or Die 3.
And that went number one. So that was a good thing. And then we did the Gucci records. Actually, I thought that was going to be on Gucci's album, but, you know, that's a whole nother story.
For sure,
Shout out to Gucci.
He releases so much, I don't know how anyone keeps track.
Yeah, man, you know what I'm saying? So I don't even know if I'm on the album, which, you know, I'd be needing them placements, you know. But not too much is going on with me because I've kind of been quiet because I've been in a publishing deal that I've been getting a runaround with for a while since Sony bought the company out. So I kind of been not trying to do a lot of placements. You know what I'm saying? Because you know how that goes. You do records and they want to claim the records and stuff like that. Just trying to get out this publishing deal with Sony ATV, man. You know, so I'm just leaning back trying to be a free agent and then I'm going to go back to work, you know. So I'm just really just leaning back, man. You know, the track's still here. You know?
Yeah.
And so, but, To really answer the question though, what I'm doing, I got like 10 young producers that I've been, while I've been quiet, I've been training some young producers. So I just put one in the industry named Naj B. He actually helped me with the Trap or Die 3 stuff. So now I got 9 more to put in the industry. So
I've been training, that'll keep you busy.
Yeah. So, but they're already set go. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like one produces EDM, you know what I'm saying? All of them can do trap, R&B, you know what I'm saying? So I'm just waiting to, get out this publishing deal. And then, my label starts, which is Red Umbrella Music. And, I'm gonna start placing my producers.
Nice. And what do you mean by training? What does that consist of?
You know, teaching them how to use the MPC sequencing and how to play. You know what I mean? Like basically, I've been training them to have the signature sound of me. I've done that with a lot of producers. You know what I'm saying? So I've just been training them, man, to be able to go in and make beats on the spot. And not just sit on a laptop and click buttons. You know what I mean? So all I have to do is just, you know, place them and you'll see Naj B in the future, like real soon. So just remember I said it, Naj B.
Awesome. We will keep an eye out. Shorty Red, thanks for coming by.
Hey, thanks, man.
All right. I first reached out to Shorty when I was researching an article about the history of trap music. One of the things I quickly figured out about the style was just how big a role Shorty played in it. His influence on today's sound is literally inescapable. So it was important to me to get to the roots of his story, what his influences were, and how he came up with his ideas. I think this interview really got to the bottom of that, and hopefully provided some perspective on the early years of rap in Atlanta, and how you can hear the echoes of Atlanta bass all over today's hip-hop. Join us next week for a very special 200th episode of The Cypher. Our guest will be longtime friend of the show, poet Kevin Koval. We'll discuss his new book, A People's History of Chicago. But since it's a big anniversary for us, we've packed in some crazy stuff about The Cypher as well. If you're a fan of the show, this is an episode you won't want to miss. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with another influential Southern rap artist, Scarface, on number 104. Whatever you use to listen to the show, iTunes, Apple's Podcast, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us a buck a month, we could at least afford to eat while researching and editing. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Become a patron by the end of May to get access to June's file. This month, we have the great producer and engineer Skef Anselm talking about the positive effects of sampling for unknown artists, what it was like to meet the producers he influenced, and the interconnectedness of the New York music scene. Previous months have included unreleased Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotaro.
They used to call me Baby Michael Jackson.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Once you learn how easy it is to do this and do that, you're out of here.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
It sounds like you don't really hear those sounds nowhere.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
That's probably like the first time I ever heard that guy's name.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Renee Goldenbeld.
If it wasn't for that guy, my family wouldn't be eating.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Any type of negativity, you know what I mean? They just love it, you know? And I be trying to, people just assume that I'm this certain type of dude, which really I'm not.